Well, hello, everybody. I'd like to call to order the October meeting of the San Luis Obispo Health Commission. We received the minutes from last meeting, and I'd like to ask the commissioners if there's any changes they see. And if not, I'd like to get a motion to approve.
Second.
I believe that was moved and seconded. So all in favor of accepting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Great. I'd like to open up the session to a public comment, and a public comment is for a person's desiring to speak on issues other than those scheduled items that are within the scope of the Health Commission. So are there any public comment? Yes, please.
Okay, does the clock start now?
As soon as you tell us who you are.
Okay, I'm Ginny Montine. I'm a resident of San Luis Obispo.
Thank you.
And I wanted to speak about October, we all know, is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Okay, that's a very important concern. I'm a survivor myself. I know how important it is. However, there's a part of this that maybe you're not so aware of, and that is that it can be used by large companies to promote their products, and those products will actually be harmful or causing breast cancer. And I've passed out a couple of sheets, and a term that they use is calling it pink washing. And this year, the Susan Komen Foundation commissioned a perfume to sell for part of the October event. And it contains two toxic and hazardous substances. Now, this just runs counter to what makes sense. You know, we've got to be reducing these kinds of hazards. I think we're all aware. I think if you went out on the street and asked somebody, are you aware of breast cancer? You know, odds are you're going to know a good friend or a relative who has either survived or not. What we need now is prevention. And as much as 80% of cancer is actually environmentally linked. So you as members of our health commission stand in a position to be able to make a difference. You could make recommendations to the Board of Supervisors that they use precaution rather than just to race ahead, to tell the buying departments to select products that are less harmful. You know, it doesn't have to be extreme. Any progress we make in that direction will really make a big difference. So let's end the pink washing and start the prevention. That's what I want.
Thank you. May I ask you a question?
Yes.
How do we know if it's been pink washing? How can we tell?
Well, there is a list in there that gives you steps to ask. You know, if you're thinking about buying a product or entering into a race or a walk, you might want to ask these kinds of questions to find out how much of the proceeds are really going to a a cancer organization. And it turns out to be generally, I don't think I brought the specifics, but they, if you go to Think Before You Pink on the webpage, they will have specific examples of, like, this $59 perfume maybe gives a dollar to breast cancer. And, you know, that's not really helping.
Thank you.
Yeah, any other questions? All right. Thank you for your time.
Greetings, Health Commission. My name is Jennifer Joswick. I'm a resident of San Luis Obispo County. I'm also on the San Luis Obispo Surf Rider board, and I'd like to tell you what happened to me on Saturday. Saturday was a beautiful day after the clouds disappeared, so my husband and I and a friend, we were checking the surf. We looked around Shell Beach. We looked around Silver Shoals Drive, and then we went and looked at Spyglass Park, and we decided the waves looked better at Silver Shoals Drive, which, if you're familiar with that area, there are stairs that go down Beachcomber Street that are public access stairs, and there's also a goat trail that goes down from a cul-de-sac at Silver Shoals Drive. So I went down the Beachcomber stairs because I prefer the stairs. My husband walked down the goat trail. When we got out into the ocean, I think I'm losing my mic there, we both noticed, and so did my girlfriend, that something really smelled bad. I said, it smells like something's dead. You know, I was waiting to see a sea lion carcass or something like that, because when you're surfing, you frequently see those things on the beach or you smell them. And we kept looking around. Well, nothing. Okay. So we kept surfing because it was a beautiful day. And there were a few other people in the water and people on the beach. About 4 or 5 hours later, she texted me and said, did you know there was a sewage spill in Shell Beach on Indio Drive? I just watched KSBY news. And I said, no. I said, there were no signs at the Beachcomber Stairs. There were no signs at Silver Shoals Drive, where the county health has the flip sign. There were no paper signs. So I went and looked on the KSBY website, and it says, sewage line break causing raw sewage leak in Shell Beach. This is dated October 14th at 9:54 p.m. So I saw that Saturday evening because I looked on the website. And then I went to look in the Tribune. I looked online, and it said, dated on the 15th Saturday, that there was a 6,000 gallon of raw sewage spilled in the ocean near 96 Indio Street in Shell Beach. Now, if you're familiar with Indio Street, it runs parallel to the ocean. It's the closest access spot to the ocean is the Beachcomber Stairs, which I went down. So it's within a quarter mile, or even closer, of that surf spot. That day there was a combination swell, so there was swell coming from the northwest, and there was swell coming from the south. So it's very likely that that sewage could have traveled to the surf spot. So today, I looked on the county health site, the environmental of county health, to see, okay, there should have been something posted on the website. So as of today, I saw that the last time it was updated was October 13th. So that's before the swell, or before the spill, excuse me. There's no health advisories listed for this area that they test. So there was no mention of the spill. On their website, it does say a beach closure occurs when a specific beach location is closed to all water contact activities due to a higher health risk associated with known hazardous waste spills, such as untreated sewage, reaching recreational waters. I believe that Friday, with 6,000 gallons of sewage spilled less than a quarter mile from the surf spot where my husband and my friends and I were surfing, that this would qualify for a valid reason to warn the public. They have not warned the public, and this is not the first time. No paper signs were posted. It was not posted on their website. I'm really disgusted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. My name is Jennifer Blonder. I'm a resident of San Luis Obispo, and I am the secretary for Surf Rider Foundation San Luis Obispo. And I just kind of want to back up what my friend Jen was saying, and I'm disgusted too. I mean, it's pretty plain and simple. The water is the reason that a lot of people come here. The water is the reason a lot of people live here. And if we can't safely go into our water because there's raw sewage floating around, there's a real issue there. And if we can't make an informed decision before we go into the water because there's no postings on the website where a lot of surfers look, because the county is supposed to be doing their job by posting the sewage spills. And if the only place that we have is the news to go look in the morning to find out whether or not it's safe to go in the water, I don't even have a television. I don't watch television. I can't believe that a sewage spill of that size would occur and there would not be not just signs down there, but people stopping people from getting into the water. Why would the city or the county allow that to happen? I'm very confused. I'm very disgusted. And I would love for you guys to please make some recommendations to the county, perhaps, to stay on top of their website. It still hasn't been updated since that sewage spill. That's ridiculous. And also, perhaps some recommendations to the city for putting up proper signage or having some officials out there just to let people know. That's, you know, more than a hazard. Swimming in raw sewage, I can't even begin to list all the possibilities of sicknesses that you could get from that. And I'm sure none of you would like to be swimming in sewage either. So I would just really encourage you guys to make whatever recommendations you need to so that we are more informed before we go into the water. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
I have a question for Jennifer or
Joss.
Oh, you're both Jennifer. My apologies. Did the KSBY or any other news outlet indicate what the cause of the sewage leak was?
KSBY's website.
Excuse me. Thank you.
I'll read you what both the Tribune and KSBY say. KSBY says Indio Drive and Shell Beach was blocked off Friday night due to what neighbors say is a sewage line break. The break has caused a massive amount of an unknown substance to shoot up into the air, possibly onto homes. Neighbors tell us it is raw sewage, but the city says it is only water. When KSBY arrived on the scene, crews were hosing whatever the substance is down into drains, which goes directly into the ocean. Stay with KSBY News for more information. Well, this was Friday, and their news report, which I did see on Saturday night, said that it was sewage and said to avoid water contact. The Tribune reported, and I don't have the time, 6,000 gallons of raw sewage was spilled into the ocean Friday near 96 Indio Street in Shell Beach, according to the San Luis Obispo County Health Agency. So that tells me that the health agency knew, right? The department said people should avoid contact with water near the storm drain where the spill occurred. The spill was the result of a failed bypass pipe. Okay, if they knew, where were the paper signs? Why wasn't the sign flipped at Silver Shoals Drive? If they have to test to find out if the sewage is contaminating the water before warning people, I think that's a problem. I think it would be better to warn the public and conduct their tests later to show if there's high bacteria or not. So I did email County Health this morning. I did not receive a response from them. So I do appreciate all you can do to encourage them to stay on top of important things like this. As you know, we have several sewage spills a year up and down our coast here.
Is 96 Indio a specific address?
I believe that's an address. Yeah, because Indio Drive is the street that runs alongside the ocean. And there's houses on both sides. So there are beachfront homes.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Warren?
Yes, I have a question for Dr. Borenstein on that. With the County Environmental Health, who's on call on the weekends for something like this, and how are these spills, when they happen on a weekend, how is that handled when somebody's supposed to go out and take care of these warnings?
Yeah, so I was made aware of this on Friday evening, and our procedures are that we do a media release for a spill of any size. I had just turned to one of my colleagues and said, I know in the state that I came from, such public releases didn't happen until you got to 30,000 gallons. Now, I know that might surprise some people, and I saw your reaction, but 6,000 gallons, though it sounds like a lot, is when you put it into the ocean, not of major consequence. Now, I cannot tell you specifically what did not have communication with environmental health staff today about anything posting, and I certainly will take that back and get a more informed piece of information back to you about the nature of the spill and the details. I won't get into specifics because I am certainly not a technician in this area, but I know that it has to do with the size, the distance, the where the outlet is, and in an ocean, I suspect that part of the reason is that a 6,000-gallon spill is actually quite small when it's into the ocean. But I will definitely get you some follow-up information on the details.
I have one other question along that line. Since this happened in the city down there, how is the relationship with the city in contacting the county when there's these types of emergencies?
So I'm sure they went through Sheriff's Dispatch and got the environmental health person on call who in turn notified me that she would be issuing the media release. I did not get a ton of detail. Again, that's why I don't want to speak on the details of the particular situation since I don't have that at hand. But the communication between what's called PSAPs, any public safety, I forget what the A is, point of communication goes from that entity to the county's entity and in turn to whoever is on call for the particular situation.
So, I have another question. So what's the procedure for a citizen to make a call? Would be to call law enforcement? Is that what you said? To call the sheriff's department would notify public health? Is that what?
No. Any breach of sewage line or waste lines or anything that the proprietor, be it public or private, is required to make a report to the jurisdiction of responsibility. And if it is of an environmental health nature, then they in turn will go through our county's dispatch office to get the environmental health person. The same would be true if there were an outbreak of a disease that might get reported, you know, any kind of 911 call or any call that might go to the local jurisdiction would then be routed upstream to the sheriff's dispatch, is just what we call the sheriff's watch commander, is who answers for the county.
So it would be PISMO PD? Someone would call and then they would go to the dispatch center and the dispatch center would then call the health department?
It could go that way. It also could go to state entity that handles environmental reports, and they in turn then would send it back down to the local.
Yes.
Hello. The technician said my regular mic wasn't working, and this is. Can you hear me now?
No.
Now?
No.
Okay.
It might be on the bottom.
Huh?
I'm not clear whether we have someone on call. That what if it was 30,000 gallons? I mean, we know that a sign didn't go up. What's going on here?
Well, again, I said I need to get the details about what the material was, where it was, when it happened, what, you know, and if it's 9 o'clock at night, that's the other important factor on this that I left out. 9 o'clock at night. The expectation, I believe, would be that that would be gone out to sea by morning because of the dilution effect. So we do have someone on call for environmental health at all times, and depending on the nature of circumstances, we absolutely send people out into the field at any time of day or night, and it would be very much incident-driven. So, you know, when we had a large breach in a lake not too long ago, we took great precaution that turned out not to be necessary, but to issue a bottled water recommendation as an example. So each situation just really needs to be looked at for all of the dimensions of time of day, where, what, amount, et cetera. We have environmental health specialists that go out on hazmat events. We have them on fires in restaurants to make sure the restaurant is good to open. So the call system worked. I can't give you the level of detail that you need to feel that that the actions that were taken were sufficient to the circumstances. And if they were not, then I'll be the first to say mea culpa. And
sounds like we need more information. And maybe this is a real good future item when we get down to prospective future items that we can concentrate on and maybe review what are the break points at which, or the point of, after which we start notifying, and what is that notification process, and how does it go out to actually buffer the people, the citizens, against what could be out there. So maybe we can do something at a future date, maybe even next month.
I would suggest that we have a report next month on the details of this, what happened and how did it happen, what was done, and
right.
Next month, right.
Okay. Yes.
Yes, I agree with Commissioner O'Dell, but for right now, I think I'm guessing you're planning to communicate with directly with the people from Surfrider as soon as you find out what went wrong there or what happened there. I hope that's what will happen, that you'll communicate directly with them.
Sure. I understood at least one of the speakers to say there was an attempt made to reach someone in environmental health today, and I will absolutely find out if message was received. I don't know if it was a voicemail or a particular person, so I can definitely touch base and follow through on that.
Yeah, and if you do, within your department, do a root cause analysis on what happened, maybe let us know what happened with that and what we can expect in the future.
One thing I can point out as a point of information is we're required in this state to report any sewage spill. It may be of above 1,000 gallons.
Okay.
And so that's why the media report happened, because that's a legal requirement. But again, I will absolutely provide feedback at the next meeting, and we'll make sure that there's a response to those who tried to reach out to our environmental health folks today.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Next on the agenda is an overview of the Health Promotion Division of the Health Agency and Public Health Department. And Kathleen Carley is with us. Welcome.
I'm going to wait for Jean to get me set up there. Yeah, that'd be great.
Stand-up comedy.
Now it works.
So, there we go. So thank you for having me here today. My name is Kathleen Carley, and I'm the Division Manager for Health Promotion. I know Jesse. He's on the HIV Consortium with me, and Ed is on Heal Slow with me, and David has been on the Preventive Health Grants Committee with me, and I've known Sue for a long time. So I know a lot of you. Thank you very much. So I'm here to talk about the Health Promotion Division. And our division consists of the following programs: the Tobacco Control Program, and you're going to see under each of these programs we have a coalition that goes along with everything almost, except for WIC. We used to have a health commissioner sit on our Tobacco Control Coalition, but we haven't had one lately. If any of you are interested, we'd be very welcoming. Our Obesity Prevention Program, which is our Heal Slow Coalition. Our Oral Health Program, we have an Oral Health Coalition. Our Injury Prevention Program, which is new, we have an Injury Prevention Coalition, AIDS Grants Oversight, and we have an HIV Consortium, and then our WIC program. So I will start with tobacco control. Tobacco control is a program that's been around since the early 90s. There are three funding sources which fund tobacco control. The Prop 99 grant is taxation on cigarettes. That was a Prop 99 in 1998, or I guess it's 1999. And there's a quarter tax on cigarettes, and we get a portion of that. Each county in the state gets a portion of that to do tobacco control work. We also have a small First Five grant, and we have we get money from the Master Settlement Agreement. And I don't know if you all remember, but the states got together, 48 of the states got together, and they sued the tobacco companies for all the disease and death that their product was causing. And as a result, there was a 20-year settlement, billions and billions of dollars. And the money goes to the states, and the states funnel it down to the counties. In our county, we were very lucky. There was a measure that was put on the ballot by the Medical Society many years ago that stipulates that this funding go towards health. And so we get a portion of that funding as well for our tobacco control program. Our program consists of two full-time health education specialists, and we have administrative support. I work in all of the programs, so you're not going to see me up there anywhere, but I have my hand in all of them. But we have actually two full-time people that do tobacco education work. And that picture you see, they were actually up in Cambria in March of this year. They worked with the middle school up in Cambria and did tobacco education work on Kick Butts Day. And they actually went to all of the middle schools in the entire county, and they did Kick Butts activities with kids. Because we know if you can catch kids early enough, you can prevent them from becoming addicted, and you can prevent these problems from occurring. Our tobacco control program, because it's grant-driven, our funding, we have very specific objectives that we have to achieve. One of our objectives in this work plan, we're starting our second year on it, is banning smoking in multi-unit housing. I'm sure you've read a lot of the research out now says that if you live in an apartment complex and you don't smoke, but your neighbor does smoke, the smoke comes through the ventilation system, it seeps through the cracks in the doors, and so you could be a person and have young children, and they could be getting secondhand and thirdhand smoke just from their neighbor. You don't even have to smoke in your apartment. So we've been working on getting policies in place to ban smoking in multi-unit housing. What we found, we did a lot of research, and what we found was that there were a lot of apartment complexes that already banned smoking in their units. They're not doing it so much from the health perspective. They're doing it more from a financial perspective. Smoking is the number one cause of house fires in apartment complexes. And it's also extremely expensive to turn over a unit after you've had a smoker in there. I've seen some of the costs. They say the average cost on turning over a unit is about $5,000 per unit. You usually have to rip out all of the drapery. You have to get rid of the carpet. You have to do extensive painting and repairs. And so from a rental management perspective, it makes a lot of sense to just tell people they can't smoke in their unit anyway. One of our biggest successes on multi-unit housing, we've been working with HASLO, which is the Housing Authority of San Luis Obispo, and they recently agreed to ban smoking in all of their federal units. They have two complexes, one which is their local nonprofit, and then the other which is their HUD units, their Section 8 units. They're banning smoking in all of their Section 8 units as of January 2012. So there's 16 units that they're going to ban smoking in. So it's been a major success, and we've been working with them very closely to get this policy in place. A lot of work on development, and we actually wrote a policy for them so they didn't have to do too much work, but we've been working very closely with them and with Carol Hatley at the Housing Authority, and they've just been wonderful. Our second objective up there is tobacco retail licensing. That's an objective that cities enact ordinances. The county has one. The city of San Luis Obispo has one. The city of Arroyo Grande has one. The city of Grover Beach has one. And what it is that the city council or the board of supervisors enact this ordinance, and there's a small fee that tobacco retailers pay per year. Typically averages around $300-$400 a year. And then with them paying that fee is used to fund compliance checks. So what happens is we get underage students. We recruit them from Friday Night Live chapters. We get underage students, and they go in and they try and buy tobacco. And in the cities that have this tobacco retail license ordinance, sales rates to minors are lower than in jurisdictions without the ordinance. A case in point, the city of Pismo Beach does not have an ordinance, but they do compliance checks once a year. That's written into their work plan. The last compliance check they did, which was in February, 41% of the stores sold to minors, and that's a very high rate. It's usually less than 10% if there's a tobacco retail license on the books. So we continue to work with jurisdictions that don't have these ordinances and try to get them passed. It's a hard sell in today's economy because any additional tax that goes on business, there's a lot of resistance from elected people to tax business any more than they're already taxed. So it's an uphill battle, but we continue to work on tobacco retail licensing and compliance checks. Our third objective is developing a stronger coalition. You know, reaching out more to hard-to-reach populations. We've identified the medical community, it's not that they're not supportive of tobacco control, but we don't get a lot of interaction with medical professionals because they're often very busy. We've identified youth, particularly college-age kids, and we're also reaching out more to businesses and trying to get more business support in our efforts. And then our fourth thing that we're working on is cessation. And we do cessation for the general public as well as for pregnant women and parents of children 0 to 5. I thought what I would show you is some cessation data from this past fiscal year. In the past fiscal year, we got 377 referrals from people in the community for our cessation programs, and 78% of them attended at least one class, which is actually very high. In the past, we have an excellent cessation counselor, Kitty Farhar, who's working on this, and she's done a tremendous job. And in the past, we were lucky if we got maybe 40% of the people to attend a class. But she reaches out to people, and she tries to develop a connection before the class even starts. You'll see that our number one referral source is community health centers. They send us a lot of people. But then the number two source, which Kitty is very proud of, is family or friend. And it's because if somebody's gone through and they've had a good experience, then they recommend their friend to attend the same program. So Kitty was very happy with this statistic. And then it goes down. Excuse me, I'm getting a little cold. Here's our follow-up for clients who quit. At 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months. And let me explain to you. So first of all, that's the eligible, the people that were eligible for follow-up. And then you see over there the number that were contacted. Every one of those 135 we attempted to contact. But it's very difficult sometimes to get through. First of all, the population we're dealing with, let me give you a little background. In San Luis Obispo County right now, our smoking rate is about 11%. We're one of the lowest rates in the state. The national data is low 20s, but we're 11%. The people that continue to smoke in our county tend to have other issues, such as mental health or drug and alcohol issues. And I see Sue shaking her head, high rates of smoking in people with drug and alcohol issues. Many of the homeless population smoke, and you'd think, why do they smoke? Because they don't have any money and they're wasting their money on smoking. Well, it's one of the few things that they do have money for. So the population we're dealing with, it's difficult to get in touch with them a lot of times. Their cell phone may have been turned off. They don't want to answer the cell phone because they know that they're continuing to smoke and they don't want to tell us that they're not smoking. So we make attempts for everybody, but we don't get through to everybody. So at 3 months, our quit rate, and we only count the people we got through to whether or not they quit. We assume that the people we didn't get through to are still smoking, so we don't count them in our favorable statistics. But at 3 months, we have 31%. You can see at 6 months, we had a 40%, but we had less people that we contacted. So the statistics, if you did a statistical test, it's probably not a valid jump in our cessation rates. And then at 12 months, we have about 22%. Nationally, 25% or so is about what you'll find at a 12-month cessation rate. It's very difficult to quit smoking, as any of you who have ever smoked know. But we're very proud of what we have been able to achieve. The next program I'll talk to you about is our obesity prevention program. We have, this is funded by General Fund, plus we have a new SNAP-Ed grant, and I'm going to spend a little time talking to you about it. SNAP-Ed is nutrition education for people who are eligible for the CalFresh program, CalFresh. CalFresh is the new name for food stamps. Okay, and so this is a new grant that we were extremely fortunate to get. And our obesity program has two full-time health education specialists. One of them is being hired specifically to work on SNAP-Ed. And we also have a 0.25 dietitian and some administrative support. We use a socio-ecological model when we're doing our obesity prevention work. And that model is layered. Some people call it an onion. When I started in the healthcare field in 1986, I managed an obesity program at San Luis Medical Clinic. And it was a structured program, clinical care, a year's worth of education. People had to attend every week for a year. I can't even think what we thought of for them for a year's worth of classes, but we did. But what happened after about 5 years was everybody gained their weight back. And they gained their weight back because we only focused on the individual. We didn't focus on everything else that was going on around them. And so now we're very cognizant in our obesity prevention work that we think of this layer, and we think of the individual as well as their community, as well as their work site, and as well as policies that we can pass. I know this is a busy slide, but our health education specialists in obesity prevention, they've been working very hard on two major projects. One is Rethink Your Drink, and I don't know if you've heard about this before, but Rethink Your Drink is a nutrition campaign where you get people to rethink what they're drinking. Water is the preferred beverage. You're trying to get people out of sugar-sweetened beverages because we know there's a direct correlation between the rates of obesity and the amount of sugar-sweetened beverages that they drink. And so they've made so far 174 presentations out in the community, reaching almost 3,000 parents and kids. And they've done 36 train the trainers with local organizations so that they can then carry the ball and they can teach this. So it's been a tremendous effort and tremendously successful. But what they came back to me and they told me was they did such a good job that, like the Y, for example, we've been in the Y for the past 3 summers working with the kids in the Y program. The organizations came back and said, look, we love Rethink Your Drink, but you have anything else? So this year we had some very talented interns that worked with our health education specialists, and they developed a curriculum called Go Slow Whoa, which is a snacking curriculum which marries perfectly with the Rethink Your Drink. And so they use a stoplight to say, so green is a healthy snack. That's something that you can have anytime. Fruits and vegetables, or I mean, there's a lot of options. Yellow is a snack. You should watch how much you're eating. I mean, you can have it, but you wouldn't want to have it every day. And then red is a snack. You really don't want to have that except for on very special occasions. And it's an interactive thing. They've got kids jumping up and down like the stoplight, and kids love it. We just started implementing that in August of this year. They've already made 12 presentations, and they've reached 256 parents and kids. So we're going to continue that effort as well. And then the other thing, Ed is on a committee with me, and we're ready to take Heal Slow to the next level of policy work. We're ready to start pursuing a buy local policy. So why buy local? First of all, it's an economic stimulus. You know, it encourages your regional food system to prosper. It's symbolic. I mean, most of these policies, you're not going to have a policeman going around writing tickets if it wasn't local that you purchased, but it's symbolic. And jurisdictions and jurisdictional leadership plays a big role, and then what trickles down to the rest of us. It protects agriculture, particularly small and mid-sized farms. Climate change, it's related to climate change, and the adaptation plan that the county wrote, one of the adaptation strategies was pursue buying local because it reduces the greenhouse gas emissions that are required to transport foods into our economy. When you focus on local products, it improves the nutritional value of foods. We all know you pick these, you know, grapes in South America and they sit around forever till they finally get to our table. By the time we get them, the nutritional value has been diminished. And then it encourages healthy food choices. So we have a subcommittee that's working on this right now. We meet again next week, and we're ready to start taking it to some jurisdictions and try to get a buy local policy passed. And then finally, in obesity prevention, our SNAP Ed grant. As I said before, this program is targeted to people who would be eligible for the CalFresh program, which is up to 185% of the federal poverty level. We have very specific goals in there. We're going to be working with others who provide SNAP Ed education, and that includes WIC, the Department of Social Services, the UC Extension, and the Food Bank. So we'll develop a little subcommittee of Heal Slow, and so we're all on the same page with what we're doing. We're going to develop a 5-series nutrition class that we have to reach at least 350 eligible people. We're going to continue Rethink Your Drink and reach 300 more people. CX3 is a planning process. Excuse me. You look in a community and you look at the billboards that are available, and you look in the little markets, the corner markets, and you see if there's fresh fruit and vegetables available, and you see how many fast food places exist in a certain area. So it's a very detailed planning process that we will participate in. We're going to do some single session nutrition classes. We're going to go into WIC sites. We're going to go to Food Bank. We're going to do what they call Harvest of the Month, which is really promoting certain fruits and vegetables and presenting different ways to prepare them so that they're attractive and people want to eat them. And then we've got some media activities. So again, this was a windfall. Penny would probably tell you she was sitting at her desk one day and somebody called and said that they were going to give us a bunch of money. And you think, right, you know, I mean, sure, you're going to give us a bunch of money, but it was true. And so we're very fortunate to have been the recipient of this. Oral health, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because I know Tracy came and talked to you about oral health a couple months ago. Tracy is our full-time oral health program manager. She has an amazing resume. She was the oral health director for the state of Colorado prior to coming to the county. This program is funded through several different mechanisms. One, we bill for the application of fluoride varnish. There's some administrative money that we can pull down for her matching kids with dental providers and trying to coordinate activities in the community. And then we also have a small grant through First Five. 50% of Tracy's time is spent on clinical care. She's out at WIC sites, at Head Start sites, at state preschools, and she's also working with POGE, which is the Perinatal Outreach Extended Group, which is a program for mothers with drug and alcohol issues through drug and alcohol. And so she's out at doing clinical care, doing dental assessments, and providing fluoride varnish and linking these kids with dentists. And then 50% of her time is spent on coordination. We've got a coalition. You know, she helps get the children into care. She talks to parent groups, et cetera. So we're thrilled to have this program in our county. Our injury prevention program, well, we had a grant problem because we were awarded a grant. Well, we thought we were awarded a grant last November, and then by March they'd taken it away. We never really got it, you know. And what had happened, it was an internal thing with the state. There was a state law that said if the state was contracting San Diego State University to do this program for them, and there was new attorneys that came on in the contract unit at the state. And the new attorney said, well, there's a law that says if you can do this yourself, you can't contract with someone else to do it. And so they battled it out for about 4 months, and finally the lawyers won. And so we don't have that grant right now, but I've been told by someone at the state that we may get it back. One of the good things that happened was right after we got the grant, we started to work, and we've got a great coalition. It consists of both of our hospitals, Highway Patrol, police, fire, local nonprofits. It's a wonderful coalition, and they still want to do some things. So we're piecing this together, but we really don't have any staff devoted to it other than, again, a piece of me. We do get a little bit of money in injury prevention for all the tickets that are written for not wearing a seatbelt. A tiny bit of it funnels down to public health. We get about $2,500 a year. So we've used that money with, and we've also raised some other local funds, and we've bought some car seats, and we've distributed them to low-income families. And we actually had a car seat checkup on Saturday, September 18th. And we were in the Target Shopping Center, and we saw 36 car seats. None of them were installed correctly. And we gave about 6 away to people whose car seat was so in such terrible condition that they shouldn't drive away with it. And then our AIDS program. I don't know how many of you have been on the Health Commission, but in 2009, the state of California, we used to get over $1 million in AIDS funding. The state of California eliminated all general fund support for AIDS programs. And so our program was basically dismantled. All we have left are 2 grants. We provide, or I provide, oversight only, and then we've got some fiscal oversight as well. We take a 7% administrative fee, which is less than we could take, but it's, you know, we take as little as possible. And the rest goes to AIDS Support Network to provide the services. The Ryan White grant is now down to $101,000, and those dollars provide medical care and supportive services for people living with HIV and AIDS. And then the HOPWA program is housing opportunities for people with AIDS, and that's a HUD grant, and there's $160,000 in that grant, and that grant provides housing locally for people with AIDS, and then there's also some supportive services in that grant as well. One thing, it's not really part of the AIDS program, but it's related, is our syringe exchange program. The syringe exchange program is operated, excuse me, AIDS Support Network is the fiscal agent, and there's a local nonprofit that actually does the syringe exchange. We give them free space in the public health department, and they're there on Wednesdays and the first Saturday of every month. And they take in syringes from drug users, and they exchange them for clean syringes. And this is a project that is meant to reduce the incidence of AIDS and also of hepatitis C, because we know historically people that use abuse drugs tend to use dirty syringes if they can't find anything. So we try and give them clean syringes so we can reduce the incidence of disease. you can just look at this graph and you can see how successful the program has been, particularly in this last year. It took a while for the people to become trusted in the drug-using community. I mean, they didn't want to think if they came in and they did this, they were going to get arrested. And it took, you can see, about 3 years. And on the fourth year, it's taken off and it's gone mad. So now the issue is enough funding to buy the syringes. Syringes are cheap, but they're still, you know, giving out a lot of them on an annual basis. And then WIC. And I'm going to let Linda talk about WIC. I'm just going to point one thing out to you. One thing we were very fortunate to do in this last budget year was reorganize WIC. Prior to this last budget year, everyone in the WIC program, and there was like 17 people, including temp help, reported directly to Linda. And that is just an overwhelming burden. So we reorganized it, and we created some mid-level supervision so that not everybody reports to her. And so you see that you've got the Grover Beach site, the Paso Robles site, there's a travel team, and there's a breastfeeding program. And again, I'm going to let her talk to you about it. I do have a gift for all of you. It's some recipe cards from Heal Slow, so they're healthy recipes, so I'll pass that out. Do you have any questions for me before I sit down? Yeah, thank you. David?
Yeah, Kathleen, you said buy locally. What's yes. your definition of local?
Right. We're wrangling over the definition. For some people, it means 100 miles outside your county. Some counties have defined buy locally. Like New York City, for example, is working on a buy local policy, and they define buy local as anything within the state of New York. So we have not narrowed that down yet. That's probably one of the most contentious things. What is buy local? Our food shed, and, you know, I'm new on all the agricultural terminology, but the food shed we exist in goes all the way to LA County. Mm-hmm. So LA County, I think, up past Monterey. So we don't have local defined exactly yet, but it can mean many things.
No, because we don't grow everything here.
No, St. Louis.
No. Like bananas.
Yeah.
That's not very local anyplace.
Yeah. And most policies, the first policy that was ever enacted was in Woodbury County, Iowa. And Woodbury County, Iowa had a buy local, but it was their policy said buy local if you can. That's all it said. Buy local if you can.
Yeah.
Some counties have said buy local, 10% of what you buy should be local. And again, New York is anything in the state is local. So we're working on that.
Well, tell everybody to go to the farmers markets in
That's
San
right.
Luis Obispo because we have lots of them.
No, we do. We do. Thank you, David. Anyone else?
I have a question.
Yes.
Well, so the new name for food stamps is CalFresh.
Yes.
And you get a card.
Yes.
And that's how people are.
Yes. It's like it looks like a credit card. It's electronic benefits transfer, and it's like a credit card. We do not, just so you know, public health does not administer the CalFresh program. That's administered through the Department of Social Services. Okay? But we're working with them on that.
Okay, so that might answer my next question. So if someone receives food, CalFresh benefits, they can't use that at the farmer's market?
Not in our county. There are some counties that allow electronic benefit at their farmer's markets. One of the issues, and we did research it, about a year and a half ago we found a grant, and we were actually going to pursue the grant. The issue is this. At farmer's markets, all the farmers come together in like a collective. Okay, and just like every time you use your credit card, there's a fee attached to it. You probably don't know it because you pay, if it's a dollar, you pay a dollar. But the merchant you buy your product from pays a fee of 3 to 5%, depending on the credit card, depending on how much you know, their volume. And so one of the issues is how do the farmers determine who's going to pay that fee? I mean, if there's only one machine at the market, there's a lot of administrative overhead trying to figure out, okay, so Farmer John sold $2.82, so he's got to pay. And so it's more of a process, like internal figuring this out. I would imagine someday we do have EBT machines at farmers markets, and that's one of the things we will work for. But right now in our county, it's not happening.
Okay, thank you. My other question is, with regards to the CalFresh and the food shed, is there a breakdown of eligible food that people can buy with their CalFresh car benefits?
Well, no. I mean, you can't buy alcohol and you can't buy cigarettes. But other than that, you can buy food. You can go into the market and buy food.
Right. So
right.
So does the CalFresh or the consumer or the – I was looking at the policy of not the policy, but the programs of the drink – I'm sorry. Rethink Your Drink and the Slow Go Whoa programs. Do those reflect what people can purchase with food stamps?
No. Those are separate, okay? Mm-hmm. But when we start doing, remember, SNAP Ed is new. We haven't started doing it yet.
Okay.
The grant actually kicks off on November 1st.
Okay.
That will be an important component. That when we're doing these classes, like one of the sites we said we would do classes at were the Department of Social Service sites, right, where people go to get their CalFresh. Obviously, it will be important to talk to them about all of those issues. So we're in the process of designing a curriculum right now.
So, and this is more like an overall policy or policy, I guess, in general, is that the CalFresh benefits have no restrictions about what people can purchase for healthy foods?
No.
So they can buy a bag of Cheetos?
Yeah. But the reality is, frankly, I think people should be able to buy a bag of Cheetos if they want. I would hate to be the food police and tell them no. What I think a better approach would be, I mean, it would be better if they didn't buy everything a bag of Cheetos, right? But I wouldn't want to be the food police to walk around and say, oh, you can't have Cheetos, but because you have your own money, you're allowed to have Cheetos. I mean, I think it creates like a class system. So I've been working in obesity for 25 years. My approach has always been, and most of the dietitians I've worked with have been, no food you can never have, you know? It's a matter of education, quantity, and trying to eat the best meals that you can and then throw in a Cheeto every once in a while, you know?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Do you agree with me, Linda? Linda's a dietitian, you know? Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks for coming in to talk to us, Kathleen.
Sure.
CX3, I felt you went over that quite sort of quickly. It seemed you were researching something, but what if you find out that in a neighborhood there's nothing but fast food restaurants that serve food that's not very good for you? Is there any...
Well, first of all, we don't have all exactly what we're supposed to do in this yet. We've done communities of excellence in the tobacco control field, and we actually, with Heal Slow, did a little neighborhood survey when we first started, where we went into Oceano and we went into Paso Robles and we looked around the high school to figure out what was going on around the high school. You know, were there fast food places? Was there any place for kids to get fresh fruits and vegetables? You know, what was going on? And you make recommendations. The more difficult thing occurs when you're right. What if they all are fast food restaurants? I mean, can we encourage somebody to start a healthy grocery store? You know, that's time intensive, might cost us a whole bunch of money, right? We might have to give them some kind of concession. But ultimately, that's the goal of all this, to make recommendations and then see what we can come up creatively to make a difference.
Yes, sure, Quinn.
You're so dedicated and your programs sound wonderful, but I just have a comment about the smoking.
Yeah.
I'm not for smoking at all, but it seems so incredibly punitive to tell people that they can't live somewhere if they smoke, especially in affordable housing situations where people already are down on themselves. And it just seems like when you talk about the obesity programs, you're so positive. You're offering what healthy food is, and you're encouraging people to eat well. But when you talk about smoking, it's like you're not allowed to live here. You're not allowed to smoke at the beach. You're not allowed to smoke at the park. You're not allowed to smoke at the bar. You're not allowed to smoke in the restaurant. No, 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 no. And they just make these people feel like they're vermin or something. And I just can't feel that's right.
Well, first of all, you're not the only one that feels that way, okay? Believe me that we're behind as far as multi-unit housing and smoking ordinances are concerned.
the city of Boston, which is much larger than Haslow, just passed an ordinance where all of their multi-unit housing for their HUD properties will be smoke-free as of January 2012. The difference between tobacco and obesity, first of all, tobacco is still the number one killer in our society. I mean, despite our lowered smoking rates, it's still the number one killer. And if I'm overweight, my overweight, as long as I don't give you all my Cheetos, right, you know, my overweight's not going to impact you, right? But if I smoke and I sit next to you, my smoking does impact you. And so we've got to take a little different approach. I mean, you still educate people, and you still want people to do the right thing because that's the right thing, right? So you still encourage. And believe me, Kitty works with our cessation clients, and she's extremely encouraging. And one of the, I taught cessation for years. One of the key things you tell a smoker is don't beat yourself up over this. You know, it's not, you don't want them to beat themselves up, and you don't want them to feel like a pariah. But unfortunately, if you're standing next to me and you're smoking, it's impacting my health. And so it's not that we like being bad guys. It's that, you know, we're public health professionals.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Getting back to the smoking and kind of a follow-on question to what she said, you talked about trying to ban smoking in the multi-unit housing.
Yes.
Do you guys have the authority to do that within your organization?
No. A jurisdiction can do it. For example, the city of Calabasas was the first city in the state of California. They banned smoking everywhere. They beat San Luis Obispo many years. And they banned smoking in all of their multi-unit housing, not just their HUD housing, but all of their multi-unit housing. But they did set aside 20% of the units for people that smoked. Okay? So a jurisdiction has the ability to enact an ordinance to do that. We took a softer approach because this was the first time we'd ever worked on this in our county. So we decided that a better approach would be to first figure out what was going on. So that's why we've been meeting with all of these apartment owners and apartment managers to figure out what they're doing already. And many of them already do it themselves. They don't need us, okay? But we're just working with what we call soft policies. So it's not a law. It's a policy that the apartment manager and owner enacts. And it usually says if you violate this, then you could be evicted. People's Self-Help Housing has, I used to work for them, and they're also a nonprofit housing provider. They have had no smoking in their units for about 2.5 years, and that's all of their units. And they have yet to evict anyone. They get people that don't comply, and they said it takes an awful lot of their time because, you know, it's the neighbors that are complaining. It's not the apartment manager doesn't have time to walk around and see who's smoking. It's the neighbors that complain. So they spend a lot of time with neighbor complaints, and they go back to the person, they educate them, and they give them another chance, and they give them another chance. So very few people are actually kicked out. Mostly you just want people to comply. And that's the truth with most smoking ordinances.
Now, is it the same with the retail licensing and compliance checks? You said when you send people in to check, it's a pretty high percentage that they're still selling to.
Right. And if so, in the city of Pismo Beach, for example, that had a 41% sales rate, there's nothing that can be done because they don't have an ordinance. In the city of San Luis Obispo, the city of San Luis Obispo has had an ordinance since 2005, but they weren't doing regular compliance checks, and we met with the police chief, and she started doing them again. And when they first started doing them again, they had a pretty high sales rate. And the procedure was that their city attorney wrote a letter to the retail owner and said, your license is going to be suspended, and then but you could come to court and you can appeal it. And they did come to court and appeal it. Nobody's license was suspended, but they got much better the next time somebody came in.
Thank you, Colonel, for
for coming in.
Yeah.
And I had a few questions. One of them is regarding, like, the Haslow housing and particularly Section 8.
Uh-huh.
What about individual units? Is anybody looking at maybe getting more landlords to be willing to take Section 8 if the parties agreed to be non-smoking in the home?
Well, you know, that's a question for Carol Hatley, you know. And I wouldn't attempt to answer it, but I just know historically from working at People Self-Help Housing that, you know, they're always looking for landlords. So I would imagine that that's true now as well. But you're going to have to ask to Carol as far as what they're actually doing.
Right. Okay. One of the things I'm seeing, because I do see a lot of people, they'll deal with other addictions, but tobacco's the toughest drug for people to get off of.
Yep.
And particularly with young people who have children, they're more than willing to go outside to smoke, and they don't smoke in their car, and they don't smoke in their house because they don't want the kids to have it, and I really applaud them for that, and they want to deal with it when they can. My other question is around, I'm kind of surprised, not surprised at CHCs, you know, they're referring lots of people, but how come our other doctors are so far down in referrals?
I mean, we try. We go out to doctors' offices. We send them printed materials. We put it in the public health bulletin and let them know we've got this. I mean, we try.
Yeah.
You know, I've worked with doctors for many years. I don't want to generalize and get any doctors out in the community that happen to be watching this mad at me, but I think there's probably a couple of issues. One, they're very busy and it's difficult. It's another form they got to fill out. Two, a lot of times the people that are still smoking, they don't feel have much of a chance of quitting, you know? And so, you know, they're thinking, wow, do I really need to do this? And then three, I've worked with doctors before that say, we don't need your class, we can do it ourselves, you know? So they try and do it themselves, and maybe they can, you know? But it's not for lack of trying.
I appreciate the fact, too. It seems like in the last 2 years, you guys have really added a lot of cessation classes, and they're ongoing regionally. I post the notices up when I get them, and I'm really grateful. That's something that we saw a big need for years.
Kitty is doing an amazing job.
Yeah, it's great. You guys are doing really good with that. And then my other question, if not a statement, are you guys working, say, with Farm Bureau or any of them? There's a huge local movement within the small farms and ranches to, in fact, buy local is one of their pieces, and are they involved with that?
Yes.
And we've just been involved at North County Connection with a gleaning project that's starting to...
Very familiar with it.
Good, good.
There's a new coalition in the county. It's called the Food Systems Coalition.
Oh, I haven't heard of that.
And the Farm Bureau is a major player in that.
Okay.
But on our committee... our Buy Local committee, in addition to Ed and I, are Kim Pesciuto from Central Coast Agricultural Network, Hunter Francis from the Center for Sustainability, Andrew Christie from the Sierra Club, Susan Hughes from First Five. So we have a pretty well-rounded group, and we've got the agricultural as well as the environmental as well as the health interests represented. So we feel it's a pretty strong group to move forward.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, excuse me.
I noticed on your accident prevention, you were focused on the car seats, and I know traffic accidents are one of the biggest biggest accident category. Are you working on other things like poison prevention?
No, but our plan was to do bicycle and cars. The bicycle's on hold for right now. We were working with Dan Revor with Slow Bike Coalition, but that's on hold until we find out if we got some funding to move that forward. We weren't working on poison prevention so much, but because we've got this great coalition, our maternal child health director asked to be involved in the coalition, and one of the issues that she's working on is SIDS deaths. You know, sudden infant death syndrome. And the deaths seem to have risen lately. I mean, there was a huge campaign
when my kids were little, you know, don't put your kids on your stomach to sleep, right? Back to sleep. And that campaign has kind of lessened a little bit. So Jan Campbell, our maternal child health director, asked to join our coalition last meeting, and she wants to see what we could do within our coalition to work on that issue. So it's a there's a lot we could do. We just need... the whip. And we... breastfeeding.
of a women are incidents. Provide. Out there. Out and talk to you. provide like phones. Special men. One to two. message. So giving a incidents. Breastfeeding. or blown. Checks. hospital.
System in all day. for apologize for
how big a
county's claim. The answer.
can
by is not an
their mission.